Thank you, Selena. I'll share my screen. Okay, and begin the show. The title of today's lecture is Embodied Cognition and Its Discontents. We will just begin by looking at some of the general themes one finds in the embodied cognition literature. That cognition can be understood only in relation to a thinker's bodily experiences, structures, or processes, including especially sensory and motor structures. This language is vague. It says only in relation to. It's meant to be. We will then consider some more specific kinds of theses, some more specific theses that I've put forward that are more precise as we move along. According to this view, it is misguided and unproductive to attempt to model cognitive processing in a purely abstract way, excluding consideration of bodily structures. We will also spend some time talking about this, as you might call, negative or critical aspect of the embodied cognition approach. These general themes hold for even for what are often treated as the most abstract forms of processing, such as language comprehension, decision-making, and syllogistic reasoning. So that is a big part of what is meant to be kind of revolutionary or important about the embodied cognition movement, is that it brings sensory and motor processing into what's sometimes called central cognition or higher cognition, these processes that are thought to be purely a matter of reason alone, abstract reason. And here's a quotation from a review by Fisher and Zwan. Language comprehension may incorporate and possibly even require as an essential component some activity of the motor system that could be characterized as motor resonance. We'll consider some of the ways language comprehension might be embodied in the next set of slides, subset anyway. Here is an example of research done by Chen and Barge, Barge's lab. A sample experimental result comes from a paper in 1999. Subjects are told to indicate as quickly as possible when a word appears on the monitor. They respond by pulling a lever or pushing it to indicate word recognition, depending on the block of trials. So some subjects on some trials are told to pull the lever toward themselves when they recognize a word, to push it away from themselves when they judge that the thing on the screen is a word. So many of the words shown on the screen have valence. There are some neutral words, but there are also positive and negative words. Wonderful is an example of one of the positive words they use. Phony is an example of a negative word they used. The results are that subjects react to congruent words significantly more quickly. Congruent words are those the valence of which matches the subject's response movement. On the assumption that pulling toward oneself is congruent with positive valence and pushing the lever is congruent with negative valence. So on the basis of that assumption that pulling toward oneself is a kind of a positive action, wanting something toward oneself, close to oneself. And on the assumption that pushing the lever is negative, congruent with negative valence, and we want negative things away from ourselves, then you see these results. Subjects make congruent judgments more quickly than non-congruent judgments. And this is an example of a line of research that's been very productive, research on action, congruity effects, action compatibility effects, they're typically called. An embodied interpretation of these results is that the meaning of words is partly embodied. Part of the very meaning of wonderful is the physical action of drawing wonderful things toward oneself. On this view, meanings are complex entities that include motor routines or actions. One consequence would seem to be that creatures whose bodies differ, thus having different actions available to them, therefore have different concepts or word meanings. Another example, a different research program, Daniel Casasanto on handedness. When subjects read verbs that represent actions performed with one's dominant hand, such as scribble, subjects show differential cortical activity, depending on which is their dominant hand. Scribbling is something one does with the hand one writes with. So I am right-handed, so when I scribble, I would use my right hand. Now, subjects are told only to read the verbs. They were not asked to imagine performing actions or to consider the meanings of the verbs. It's a simple reading task. Moreover, transcranial magnetic stimulation applied to premotor dominant hand areas interferes with subjects' ability to distinguish action verbs from pseudo words. So if you disrupt activity in the part of cortex that controls my right hand, then that will interfere with my ability to recognize this word, but it will have no effect on my ability to distinguish non-action words from pseudo words. Say table is a non-action word. It's not one I would use my hand for sure. So moreover, Casasanto found that the valence of objects in space is associated with handedness, even when temporarily created. So the valence of an object in space might involve asking a subject to choose between two objects, one on the right side, one on the left side. Right-handed subjects would show a marked preference for the items in the right side of their physical space. And this happens even when handedness is temporarily created. So if you have subjects wear a clumsy glove on their dominant hand, this will reverse their spatial preference for 15 minutes only, you know, small periods of time. You can force me to have a big clumsy glove on my dominant hand, on my right hand in my case. And my preference in space will shift to the left side because now it seems my left hand is available to do things and not my right. So my spatial preference switches over to the left. Neural control of approach and avoidance behavior is also lateralized in accordance with the dominant hand. So it's another kind of expression of value or valence. Right? So approach behavior, taking yourself nearer to something. Avoidance behavior, perhaps pulling away or shielding yourself, is often done with the non-dominant hand. And you see neural evidence of this kind of specialization. I'll say a quick comment in response to the note in the chat so that we don't have to wait a long time to come back to it. It's a very, very good remark. In these kinds of experiments, I'd have to go back and look at the methodology section of these particular experiments. But what is typical is that there will be independent ratings. Subjects, not the subjects in the experiment, will be brought in and given a list of words and asked to rate them for a positive and negative value. So there's some kind of independent check on this categorization. Sometimes mere kind of intuition of the experimenter is used, though that can happen as well. Now, one question about the interpretation of these findings is whether they are due to mere associations. Now, I'm not sure the word mere here is exactly correct, but it's an alternative interpretation to a strongly or a robust embodied interpretation. We might understand the preceding results as a manifestation of mere associations. For example, it may not seem surprising that we prefer to interact with things that are on the side of our dominant hand because they're easier to interact with, and that ease becomes associated with other positive evaluative representations. And more generally, we're not surprised by processes of association. If I begin riding public transportation, say the bus in my city to get to my place of employment, if I begin riding public transportation and I have positive experiences. It's calm, it's peaceful. I read while I'm on the bus. I mark papers while I'm on the bus. Then I may associate I may develop a positive association between the bus And well, I develop an association between the bus and positive concepts. If I had negative experiences when I began to ride the bus, then I may associate the concept of a bus with negative valence words. So these kinds of associations seem common in cognition. It's an extra step sort of to say that the valenced part or the bodily routine that's associated with the valenced part, that becomes part of the meaning of the word. Perhaps this is just sort of picking at the differences between different claims, but they might be important if one is trying to figure out what meaning is or what language comprehension really is. I should say, though, that even if it was best to interpret these findings as mere associations, that would not be an uninteresting result. It would be interesting, for sure, but it might take the wind out of some of the stronger claims by embodiment theorists, for example, that all meaning is embodied. In contrast, it might be that because we're embodied creatures who deploy our concepts to guide our lives in the physical world, associations naturally develop, as in my bus example, between abstract concepts and bodily routines or representations of them. So if the embodied research program as a matter of empirical investigation has produced many fascinating results, and one question, though, remains about how best to interpret them. One dimension of disagreement among those who favor embodied interpretations is between a weak embodiment thesis and a strong embodiment thesis. Now, that those terms are very general, but there is a specific distinction that's sometimes referred to in this way by, for example, Frédéric de Vinamont. Weak embodiment thesis is that neural encodings of bodily action, neural representations of motor commands, for example, play a significant role in cognitive processing. And that can be adjusted, you know, in various ways. Maybe the significant role is a deep and overwhelming role. Maybe it's a frequent and interesting role without being the dominant role. But the point here is that it's neural encodings of bodily action, not the bodily action itself, on the weak embodiment thesis. On the strong embodiment thesis, non-neural bodily activity is literally part of cognitive processing. Movement of the body or states of the body are, in this sense, cognitive states, as much so as neural states that participate in cognitive processing. So you'll see if you attend Monday's lecture, I will discuss what's sometimes called the extended mind hypothesis, or the hypothesis of extended cognition, the idea that our minds and our thought processes include things out into the world, things from our environment beyond the organism. And this is a kind of step toward that direction. The strong embodiment thesis says things beyond the brain, such as your hand, might be part of problem solving on par with the brain and sort of literally make up part of that problem-solving process. But the weak embodiment thesis says body is important, but only as it acts through body-related representations in the brain. But let's consider an example that puts some pressure on that distinction. I put things in this order because it seems as if the first two kind of research results or research programs that I discussed could easily be interpreted in the weak embodiment way. Golden Meadows' work suggests perhaps a strong interpretation. So Susan Golden Meadow and colleagues have researched the role of gesture in the child's arithmetic learning. This work raises not so much a question about meaning, about what should be included as part of the meaning of a term or concept, but about what should be included in the cognitive process. The essential early result is as follows. Take children who give incorrect verbal answers to certain arithmetic problems and observe their gestures while speaking out the incorrect solutions in front of a blackboard display of the problems. Stop and say a little bit more about the setup in the experiment or in the observations. The children are being filmed while they're standing in front of a blackboard that has a problem written out on it. And these are grouping problems, often problems that, you know, say 6 + 5 = you know, 4 + what, things like of that sort. And children have to figure out how to handle, how to fill in the blank. And they often make mistakes, especially when lures are included, when numbers are arranged in such a way to kind of trick them or mislead them. And they're just learning these problems, and then they tend to make lots of mistakes. Anyway, back to the text on the slide. And then you track the development of these children in the months to follow. Children who make appropriate gestures toward the correct answer to solving the problems, even while giving incorrect answers, are significantly more likely to give correct answers in the months to follow than children who gave incorrect answers without gesturing toward the correct strategy. So sometimes kids will make mistakes in the way they follow the equation, but while they're making the mistake in their verbal report, they will be gesturing toward the factors that they should be attending to, that they should be focusing on, instead of the ones that they're verbally discussing. And those children seem to be near transition. They are nearer to employing the correct strategy and reporting the correct answer than children who don't make such gestures. In controlled experiments following up on these results, Golden Meadow and colleagues produced results that confirm the previous work in a more controlled way. Telling children to gesture thus encourages them to convey previously unexpressed implicit ideas, which in turn makes them receptive to instruction that leads to learning. So in this case, instead of observing children who spontaneously gesture in the classroom while they're solving problems, they took children and did a controlled experiment, told some of the kids to gesture while telling another group of the kids to sit on their hands, not use their hands at all. And then gave instruction afterwards. And the children who had used gesture were more likely to respond to that instruction with improved answers. And that quotation is from Making Children Gesture Brings Out Implicit Knowledge and Leads to Learning by a group of folks from Golden Meadows lab at the University of Chicago. Is this strong embodiment? One plausible interpretation of these results is that bodily movement is actually part of cognitive processing. That is, that this is a form of strong embodiment. One unresolved confound, however, is the role of motor commands in the production of later correct results. It's possible that it is not the actual gesturing, the movement of the hands themselves, that reflects the developing child's incipient understanding of the correct strategy, but rather that the motor commands express that knowledge. On this view, it is the effect of the motor commands, or efferent copy of them, that helps lead the child to give correct, explicit answers later. It's as if the motor system is tutoring the explicit knowledge system. Though the gestures themselves may by proprioception reinforce that tutoring, but only via proprioceptive signals that come in through the brain. It's not the hand itself that does it. I take that as an unresolved issue, only to indicate how difficult it is sometimes to resolve these questions empirically. Some of the specific embodiment claims are as follows. I'm just trying to get some more specific hypotheses on the table, more specific than the original big picture embodiment claims I began with. So one claim is that all human conscious experience is entirely constituted from a foundational stock of bodily experiences. Another is that all human concepts, regardless of their connection to consciousness, are constructed entirely from sensory-motor elements. In some surprising cases, cognitive vehicles appear in sensory-motor cortex. Kind of modest, but important possibility. All cognitive vehicles appear in specifically sensory-motor cortex. That's a contrasting view. Something suggested earlier in connection with Casasanto's work or Chen and Barge's work, the body specificity hypothesis, that thinkers with significantly different physical bodies tend to have different thoughts or thought processes. There are also negative claims associated with the embodied cognition research program. And I want to focus on these negative claims for a bit because it's often, embodied cognition is often presented as a kind of revolutionary concept in the cognitive sciences. And so that requires for a revolution, a kind of departure from the existing order, the order that's assumed to involve computation and rules. And in philosophy of mind, kind of what's known as functionalism, which I'll say more about. And so it's worth trying to figure out whether these negative claims are correct. And doing so will kind of shed a lot of light on the potential of the positive claims as well. So one commonly made negative claim is that functionalism and computationalism as philosophies of mind or interpretations of cognition are false. They are disembodied approaches to cognition. Similarly, or at least another negative claim is that human minds do not deal in amodal symbols or abstract mental or cognitive representations. So often, you know, you read in the embodied cognition literature that there is no such thing as pure reason or abstract thought, that these are kind of fictions that don't recognize the central contribution that the body makes to all of our cognitive processing. All right, I'll turn to functionalism now. And here's a bit of sort of the history of philosophy of mind as it developed alongside cognitive science. The motivation behind functionalism in philosophy of mind, this would have been in the 1950s, especially the 1960s, was to allow that neurally diverse creatures and individual humans can be in the same mental state. The problem was that at that time in the 1950s and 60s, progress in the neurosciences was encouraging some philosophers and scientists to identify mental states with types of neural processes, for example, by identifying pain with the firing of C fibers. Pain is a very complicated case. It turns out, as we understand more and more about the neural basis of pain, it's harder to make this idea plausible that there would be a very identifiable neural state that is identical to pain. But the C fibers remain important. And in the early days of neural theories of pain, neural investigation of pain, it looked like C fibers were really the gist of it. But that approach is problematic because it leads to a kind of species chauvinism. It doesn't allow creatures that don't have C fibers to be in pain, for instance. So this is a problem of simple identity reasoning. If pain is identical to a certain kind of neural state, then if a creature doesn't have that neural state, it can't have pain either, because you know, that's how identity works. You would violate transitivity. If A was identical to B and A was identical to C, but B and C aren't identical, you have a violation of transitivity. So you wound up with a very specific kind of understanding of mental states. They had to be tied to a specific form of neural activity. And this can be tricky even within a single species, or within the life of one member of a species over time. The human brain changes from an earlier age to a later age. There is a posterior to anterior shift in the use of neural resources for the solving of certain problems. And so if one had identified that kind of problem solving with the posterior process earlier in a person's life, one would have to say it's a new kind of problem solving when they use different neural resources in anterior part of the brain later in life. So identifying mental states with parts of the brain seems too narrow, too local, too isolated. The functionalist wanted to capture what could be common across different individuals, across members of different species, if they were both in pain or they were both seeing a tree or something like that. Now, it's possible they shouldn't have been doing that. You know, one want to consider that possibility. Maybe it is true that when an octopus sees a reef, the octopus sees something very different from a human. And so there's no need to try to identify cases across species. We can return to that. But this was the thinking at the time. Functionalists, Hilary Putnam and Jerry Fodor were two of the most prominent ones, proposed that to be in a given type of mental state is to be in any internal state that plays a certain role in mediating between stimulus and behavior. So as a simple example, a pain is any physical state inside a creature that causes the creature to withdraw an appendage from the source of damage occurring to it. So it doesn't matter what exactly the neurophysiological or other physiological nature of that state is, if it plays the right functional role, a causal role, with this simple example of withdrawing an appendage from the source of damage, then it counts as a pain. It was, however, recognized that the effects of such a state could be modulated by the presence of other internal states, such as a strong resolve to persist in the creature's task, even in the presence of damage to its appendage. So according to the functionalists, the pain state in this case can't simply be a kind of automatic mediator leading from damage to withdrawal. It has to also play a certain role in the interior causal economy. It has to be related to another kind of state that can suppress withdrawal, a state that we might call desire to persist in the task. This led to some more precise characterizations of mental states. I'll go through a bit of this. I'll do it quickly. I'm not expecting people to, the audience members, to be familiar with this kind of formalism, predicate logic, but it's a way of illustrating what embodied theorists see as wrong with functionalism. It seems too abstract. So according to role functionalism, to be in a mental state of type M is to be in some physical state or other that plays M's distinctive causal role. Causal roles are to be characterized in terms of relations to inputs, outputs, and other mental states, and represented as, now we get to the predicate logic, in this Ramsey sentence formulation, represented in the following schematic way. This says, tried to read it kind of half in English and half in logic. It says, for any X, be for any subject, X is in mental state M sub I, so some specific mental state, in pain, belief that Mount Everest is a high mountain, you know, what have you. And if and only if there exists F1 through FN. And so each of these are meant to be specifications of internal state types, and that these existing states should be related in the way this capital T says. So you get F1 through FN. So one of those kinds of relations might be the relation of a desire to persist in the task, suppressing the withdrawal or the intention to withdraw from the source of pain, that sort of thing. And then inputs and outputs are also part of the story. And the individual is in that particular FI, that the particular functional state that corresponds to the mental state. Where I's and O's are antecedently understood predicates taken typically to express properties of perceptual input and behavioral output, and where this T thing represents the true theory of the causal relations that hold between mental properties and input and output properties, among all of those. And what's perhaps more important than understanding that particular schema is the fact that it's meant to be consistent with a physicalist or materialist approach to the mind. The idea is that what I gave on the previous slide is a specification of the kind of abstract roles of the various mental states, how they relate to each other, and how they relate to input and output. But in order for this to be a physicalist theory to fit in with a materialist view of nature and the mind, then we have to say how the functional roles are related to the physical body. And that's what a realization formula is. And this is just like the previous formula, except what's been substituted is P's for F's here. So on this view, the subject is in a certain functional state, has the state realized, if and only if they have a particular pattern of physical states that mirrors the pattern in the previous formula. That if you describe, this is the core idea, if you describe how mental states are supposed to be related to each other, and someone says, yeah, but is that person actually in those mental states? Then the question is whether they have a set of physical states that have that same structure. It doesn't have to be the same set of physical states for all beings. So sometimes that idea is called multiple realization. So it can be different physical structures in different beings or different physical structures in the same being at different times in their life. But the physical structure has to have the same set of interrelations, a kind of mirror image of the set of interrelations that you see in the functional role specifications. So here, P's represent physical or lower level properties. Given a correct theory of how mental states are related to each other and to inputs and outputs, whether something is in one of those mental states is determined by the presence or absence of a corresponding pattern of interrelated physical states, corresponding to the original formula. This is incredibly abstract, and that, as I mentioned earlier, is one of the reasons I've included it. Try to see what it is that bothers embodied theorists about the functionalist approach. This formal presentation of functionalism seems to bear no connection at all to one's bodily states or processes. And to reinforce that impression, Hilary Putnam once famously remarked, "We could be made of Swiss cheese and it wouldn't matter." There's also an important historical connection between functionalism and computationalism. Functionalists were inspired by the emerging discipline of computer science, with its emphasis on the distinction between software and hardware. The functionalist outlook came to be associated with the idea that the human mind is software that runs on the brain as hardware, or what's sometimes called wetware, because the brain's not so hard. A given piece of software is an abstract object that can be run on any suitable machine. So if you go back to the idea of realization, software is not any particular physical configuration, but it's a set of instructions that has to take some physical form or other. It can't exist apart from it used to be a floppy disk or a CD. You know, it has to, if I want to give you some software, I have to somehow convey it as a physical object to you. But the software isn't identical to the physical object. It's something I encode on the physical object and that you can remove from the physical object to put on your computer. So the thought is that the mind is the software for the brain. The one thing to notice is that even though this discussion has been so highly abstract, realization is highly constrained. Functionalist claims about Swiss cheese and about the brain as hardware come with an essential restriction. Whatever the material is, the physical material in question must be able to do the functional job. Whether a brain or a chunk of Swiss cheese is running one algorithm or another, or is in one functional state rather than another, depends on what structure the brain has to offer. Similarly for Swiss cheese. There are many different ways to build a mouse trap, for example, but the number of ways is highly constrained. There are an infinite number of ways that don't work. So just setting out a cup of coffee and saying, that's a mouse trap is pretty hopeless. You're not going to trap the mouses in your house that way. A human mind thought of as software could hypothetically be implemented in Swiss cheese, but it would have to be a very special chunk of Swiss cheese because it would have to have all of the, a whole range of states that interact in the way all of the states in the human mind do and mediate between input and output. That's science fiction. There is no such chunk of Swiss cheese in this universe. So it was a bit ridiculous of Putnam to make that claim. It has misled many folks and caused a lot of misguided discussion. On the functionalist view, the materials of the mind are not arbitrary at all. To think in a certain way, characterized functionally, one must be built from its material structure in a very specific way. It has to be a material structure that has the shape of, in terms of interrelations and dynamic changes, it has to mirror the thought process. I think it's really important to come at this from the other direction. One of the commonly given understandings, one common interpretation of those early embodiment theses I had up on the screen is that you have to understand the body. You have to study the body in order to study cognition. And this is often taken as a contrast, a point of contrast with the functionalist view or the traditional computational rules and representations based approach to cognitive science. But in fact, a computationalist or a functionalist should want to, as we might say, come at the issues from below, look at the body. Realization is what metaphysicians would call a determination relation. If we begin by looking at the physical body or a given physical machine, we could, with enough knowledge of its detailed structure, tell which functional structure or computations it can support. The physical structure determines what functions can be computed. It's determined by the physical structure of my coffee cup, that it's not a trap, maybe. If it's a short enough coffee cup, a mouse can simply jump out. Only a very narrow range of functional or computing structures are allowed by a given physical system, unless perhaps it's a fast universal Turing machine, which the human organism is not. I mentioned that though, because many discussions of cognitive science will include a chapter, say, on computational theory, on computer science, will present the idea of a Turing machine, as if these are relevant to human cognition, as opposed to just an explanation of what computation is. And that again is something I think that has led the discussion astray. Humans developed in such a way that our brains are good at solving problems, are enlisting our bodies to help solve problems, but they are not universal computing machines. They're kludgy, that is, they're sort of tricks and shortcuts and heuristics and biases all sort of put together. It's a messy system. There's a lot of interference. There's a lot of competition. There is a lot of error if you looked at this from the standpoint of a computing machine. Well, the epistemic upshot is important. Functionalism is sometimes criticized by embodiment theorists for encouraging cognitive science to study the mind without considering the brain or body or the material it's made of. But functionalism doesn't encourage that at all. If one understands the functionalist metaphysics that realizers determine functional structure, that's physical realization determines functional structure, then studying the realizers, studying the physical material, can be a very useful way to figure out which functional states are operative or which computations are being performed. The history here, I think, is one source of difficulty in the conversation. It's understandable that embodiment theorists have misunderstood this fact. Historically, one important branch of cognitive science was computer science, as applied to reasoning, game playing, etc. which focused on problem-solving strategies that are mathematically possible or mathematically optimal with no regard for physical constraints, the physical constraints of the human body. They were treated as kind of math problems. Also, there is a history of a priori theorizing about functions and functionalism in as it applies to human cognition. In the early days of cognitive science, some theorists were inclined to try to generate algorithms or routines for problem solving in humans just by reflection in the armchair. This might have resulted from laziness or arrogance, who knows, but it did seem sometimes to result from the belief that the human brain is an efficient universal Turing machine. You could treat the human as having all of the power of a universal computer, and then simply brainstorm ways that the human mind might solve problems by just thinking about the mathematical structure of the problem without thinking about the physical constraints. But any solution proposed has to ultimately be realized in the human body, and specifically the human brain. Even if one thinks only about the brain, there are massive constraints placed on it. But I should say these historical quirks were not universal, and they are not licensed by the theories of functionalism or a realistic computationalism themselves. I'll talk more about that in my first lecture in Hinnon. This leads to questions about idealistic versus realistic computationalism. When it comes to theorizing about the human mind, we must distinguish between ideal computationalism, a sort of ideal solution by a computer, and a realistic computationalism meant to model human performance. Research in artificial intelligence or the mathematics of computation can take the first form. It can be ideal computationalism. But when computational tools are used in the modeling of human performance, one should be prepared to use data about the physical system to help figure out which algorithms are being computed. That data about the physical system might come in the form of neural imaging, for example, functional magnetic resonance imaging or positron emission tomography. Now, it's an interesting question whether once functionalism is properly understood, embodiment theorists themselves are functionalists of a sort. It seems that they are. As accounts of mental processing, embodied models often posit functionally characterized structures or properties. Take image schemas, for example. These involve the relations of, for example, agent, path, and patient as they're experienced in bodily movement. But image schemas are not identified as particular neural states or processes. The schema properties involved are functional properties that can, in principle, be implemented by different collections of physical materials. I'm stuck. Okay. So you might think of embodiment theorists as fine-grained functionalists, maybe. Contemporary cognitive neuroscience emphasizes fine-grained neural mechanisms and states, looking at very kind of detailed mechanisms. That's what I mean by fine-grained, with very specific response profiles, which are then sometimes modeled computationally. This kind of functionalism leaves the armchair behind. It is what Ned Block called decades ago, psychofunctionalism, because it's based on empirical psychological research. As an example, consider Casasanto's use of transcranial magnetic stimulation. He assigns a functional role to hemispheric lateralization in frontal cortex in order to support his embodied conclusion. Remember, in that case, he disrupted the area of motor cortex that controls the dominant hand, and the earlier result disappeared. His earlier result had been that that words are recognized, action-oriented words are recognized more quickly than non-action-oriented words or words that don't involve the use of one's dominant hand. In particular, verbs, these are verbs that represent actions. But when he used TMS to interfere with processing in the area of the brain that controls the dominant hand, the facilitation effect disappeared. The subjects no longer recognized action words, words for actions completed with the dominant hand more quickly. So this, the entire logic of the experiment and the logic of the interpretation of the experiment depends on the idea that a certain part of the brain or activity in a certain part of the brain plays a certain functional role. The reason premotor cortex on the left side is relevant for someone like me who is a right-hander is because it's the left frontal cortex that controls my hand. So it's the role of controlling my hand that's important. It's not that he's especially important in that particular part of the brain. It turns out that's the part of the brain that controls my hand. But what's important for the logic of the experiment is the controlling of my dominant hand, which is a functional role. All right, so I want to make a significant shift for the second half of the lecture today. I want to talk now about the reduction of mental content. As you might have gathered from my earlier lectures, I myself am very interested in mental representation, the content of our thoughts, how that gets determined. It's a significant part of my research program. So I've spent some time trying to figure out what it would be for a thought content to be embodied, or particularly what it would be like for it to be wholly embodied. That's why I use the word reduction here. Embodiment is often described as a thesis about concepts or mental content, that all mental content or all of our concepts are embodied. All mental content is embodied content. On one way of fleshing this out, there is a primitive stock of bodily concepts, and all other concepts are constructed entirely from these ground level resources. That's the standard structure of a reduction. But what kind of content are we talking about? We say mental content, but that could mean various things. Some embodiment theorists seem to have phenomenal content in mind, the content that is present to pure consciousness. I use pure there just to emphasize that it's the focus on consciousness alone in this discussion. Perhaps this could be reduced to some primitive stock of conscious bodily experiences, but it's difficult to make this relevant to cognitive science because cognitive scientific modeling very often appeals to subconscious states. So as a philosophy of cognitive science, this thesis is of limited interest. Historically, most cognitive science has not been particularly concerned with consciousness. There are exceptions. There are some cognitive scientists in recent years who have developed such things as the global workspace model of consciousness. You may have heard of that. So I don't want to say that cognitive science entirely ignores consciousness, but most of cognitive science is focused on fast processing, lots of detailed steps in processing that we're not aware of. So a reduction just of conscious experience to a fundamental stock of conscious experiences given by the body. While it would be interesting, it wouldn't really offer a kind of revolution to cognitive science. But what if we focused on consciousness anyway? Set aside the concern I just raised and consider only consciously accessible concepts. Take the theory of metaphoric extension. On that view, there is a fundamental stock of conscious bodily experiences that provides the materials out of which all other consciously accessible concepts are constructed. At least this is one way to understand Wyckoff and Johnson's view. They often seem to be focused on conscious experiences. So take an example from Wyckoff and Johnson. Take time as our target domain and motion as our source domain. So this language may be language you're all familiar with, but the idea is that concepts develop, and importantly, abstract concepts included, develop by metaphorical extension from a source domain to that new domain, the target domain. So if time is our target domain and motion is our source, how do we understand this possible reduction? As one physically moves toward another person, the amount of motion required to make physical contact with that person decreases. The amount of time it takes to reach the person also decreases. So that might sort of understand time by that comparison. It's one aspect of the extension. Anyway. Thus, time becomes associated with motion through space, and the latter becomes a model for reasoning about the former. We begin to reason about the temporal domain by imposing structural features of the domain of motion through space onto the domain of time. For example, the subject assumes that as some temporal interval, T1 to T2, elapses, the time between the subject and some further fixed time, T3, later than T2, decreases. A projection from the structure encountered in the spatial domain. Now, one question about what's happening here is the way the extension works, how much abstraction it requires. And the examples of like time and space seem to involve the representation of abstract relations, forms of transitivity, for example. If on a straight line in space, point B is between A and C, and point C is between B and D, then point C must be between A and D. Similarly with time. So you imagine making a little, a one-dimensional line, and you've got, B between A and C. So we've got A, B, C, and C is between B and D. The betweenness of B, like between A and C, guarantees that that C will be between A and D. A picture might help, but I think you get the idea. This is similar with time. The ability to recognize such relations and to map them from one domain to another suggests a kind of logical facility typically associated with computational models of human cognition, and more importantly, maybe typically associated with abstract reason, which is opposed by embodiment theorists, many embodiment theorists. At the very least, it seems to be a form of abstraction, an ability to represent abstract structure across domains, independently of those domains. But even if we set aside this concern about abstraction, maybe there's a way to represent this metaphoric extension that doesn't require independent representation of the structural properties I was just pointing to. We still have a question about how to explain differences between our understanding of the target domain and the source domain. So my focus a moment ago on abstraction was a question about representing similarities between the two domains, an abstract feature that both domains share. If B is between A and C is between B and D, then C must be between A and D, that sort of thing. That's something they share, but there are also differences between our understanding of the target domain and the source domain. Even if apparent abstraction can be accounted for without introducing abstract representations, notice that in metaphorical extension, distinctive aspects of the target domain are added. And that's important because if something's added, then you don't have a reduction. The idea of a reduction is that all of the non-fundamental concepts have to be built entirely from the fundamental parts. So why should we think that something extra is added? Well, subjects rarely mistake time for space. They can tell the difference. And time has properties that space lacks as we understand time. For example, time is associated with aging and death, which do not seem to be grounded in bodily experience of movement through space. Now, it's possible that a new domain can draw materials from more than one domain. So you may have a kind of blending from different source domains. But that blending itself is, the details have to be worked out. Why blend one thing rather than another? Is there nothing distinctive about time? It may be that the understanding of time draws partly from our movement through space. That's one source domain. But perhaps it also draws from our feeling of physical feeling of exhaustion as we move through the day and get toward bedtime and time to sleep, right? Maybe somehow that can be incorporated and that's associated with aging and death. But, you know, that still leaves open the question how much of our understanding of time is distinctive of time. And it seems like the very reason we recognize it as a new domain, as a target domain, is because it has some properties that space and exhaustion don't have. So I think it's important to distinguish a less radical thesis from a more radical thesis, facilitation and borrowing versus constitution. And the idea of facilitation and borrowing don't lead to reduction. They don't eliminate abstract thinking altogether. They don't necessarily reduce things entirely to a basic set of conceptual experiences. Bodily experiences. It's one thing to say that experience with a source domain helps us to acquire concepts in the target domain, but it's another to say that concepts in the target domain are entirely constituted by those in the source domain. There may well be borrowing from the source domain without a complete construction from it. And some of that borrowing may be just the sort of borrowing that Lakoff and Johnson have in mind, the kind of borrowing of structure that guides inferences in the target domain. Just that if something more is added to the target domain, then certain inferences will be blocked or certain additional inferences will be added. All right, so what other sorts of content might we be talking about rather than conscious content? Because remember my first concern that I raised about a reduction of conscious experience entirely to basic bodily experiences was a concern about its role in cognitive science, that so much of visual processing, so much of linguistic processing, so much of social processing and social cognition is subconscious, and it's studied by cognitive scientists, that it seems to be that we'd need to include discussion of other kinds of content as well as conscious content if we are going to reduce cognitive scientific content to bodily content. So remember, externalist content is what a mental representation refers to, represents, designates, or is about. It's the thing that the mental representation points to. This is constituted by things, properties, or kinds beyond the symbol or the vehicle itself. To reduce all of the things we think about to bodily representations would be challenging. How might the embodiment theorist proceed? So remember, we're thinking about a kind of reduction of things represented to something bodily. And that seems to combine two very different categories. But maybe there's a bridge here. Some of our neural representations represent other internal states, perhaps motor commands to engage in bodily activity. So the typical example of a mental representation involves representation of a feature in the environment, maybe a feature that affects our visual system. But some mental representation, some of our cognitive units that represent, are representing other things within the cognitive system. And some of those might be representing motor commands related to bodily activity. But critical concerns remain. It does not seem promising to reduce the externalist content of all of our representations to the externalist content of such bodily representations. I mentally represent the president of the US, protons, the so-called World Series, et cetera. Representations of bodily routines might help me to get into contact with those reference, but those reference are not constituted by my bodily routines. It would be quite a surprise to Joe Biden to find out that he is in fact a collection of my motor routines. So as externalist content, there seems to be something really misguided about this approach. Now, there was a question yesterday about a kind of skepticism. It might be that some thinkers who lean toward the embodied approach are sympathetic to skepticism, a kind of solipsism. They think that they are alone in the universe, and that they all that they're considering is how their own thoughts are related to other of their thoughts. I have a difficult time taking that commitment seriously. It's an age-old philosophical puzzle, don't get me wrong, and I have engaged sometimes in discussion of the puzzle, but fundamentally, I believe that you audience members are there right now, and that my screen exists, and I'm using my screen to talk to you. I write papers and I send them to journals, and the journals really exist and the editors really exist. They're not all matters of my imagination or my thought process. So that distinction seems very important. It's presupposed by, for me anyway, the way I live my life. So that's why I talk about Joe Biden as a real person, the president of the United States, who's out there doing his job, talking to reporters and what have you. He can't be made up of my motor routines. So the reduction of externalist content to bodily related externalist content in me does not seem like a promising route. Well, there's a third dimension to content. Often the meaning of a word is identified with its sense. There's a famous paper called by Gottlob Frege on sense and reference, where reference is more like the externalist content. Sense is something internal to the mind. The sense of a word is sometimes characterized in terms of conscious grasp. This possibility has already been covered. But sometimes senses are characterized differently as patterns of inference or bodily routines associated with the concept or representation. Possibly these would be the patterns of inference or bodily activity that put the subject in touch with the externalist content of the subject's representations. So one of the important roles that senses were meant to play for Frege is that they determine reference. So it might be that in a very cut and dried case, a sense determines reference because the sense gives a unique description of the object referred to. And so the sense in my mind, this kind of meaning of the word, can uniquely pick something out or uniquely pick out a type of thing because it gives a distinctive definition, characterization of that thing. But there are other ways to pick out a referent or to pick out the externalist content. You can get in touch with it by bodily interacting with it. And maybe that can count as part of a sense. Mark Rowlands has argued for this, but I don't think he's the first one. Critical concerns. It is quite a challenge to reduce these patterns of inference entirely to bodily routines or actions. But a potentially deeper problem exists. If there are senses of this general sort, they can't seem to play the explanatory role we would like them to play. We would like to be able to explain inferences that subjects draw by appealing to the meanings of the concepts deployed. But one can't appeal to a pattern of inference as a sense, right? To explain inferences that subjects draw. That would be empty. It would be an appeal to a pattern of inference to explain inferences that are part of that very pattern. It would simply be to say that the subject drew that inference because the subject is in a state, the very nature of which is to draw that inference. The state is just a summary of the fact that the subject draws that inference. And that's not helpful. It would be more helpful to have a characterization of the unit itself and a content for that unit, and then talk about the conditions under which it becomes associated with some other unit, or a belief structure is formed that includes that unit, with which then will cause the inference. But to say that the inference is part of the very thing we're interested in, that removes the capacity for that to do an explanatory job for us, scientific context. All right, well, embodiment is sometimes thought of as a claim about vehicles. Jesse Prinz has considered this approach, Alvin Goldman, Frederic de Vinamont, that arguments for embodied cognition sometimes concern neural vehicles, holding that they always appear in sensory motor cortex. This seems implausible on its face. After all, what is all the other cortex doing? So, you know, there's a standard kind of mapping of the brain, areas that are more sensory oriented or involved in motor commands. But there are many other parts of the brain. And if all cognition, all concepts are a matter of neural vehicles appearing in sensory motor cortex, then all of the other cortex seems to be going to waste. So a weakened this idea might be that for the activation of any given meaning or thought process, some sensory motor cortex is involved. And there is neuroscientific evidence for this kind of approach. You can, a lot of work has been done, say, showing subjects tools or words for tools, and you'll see an activation of the area of the brain that represents words, right? But in addition, you'll see activation in motor cortex, similar to some of the things I talked about in connection with Casasanto earlier. It's that if the word in question is a tool, like a rake, for raking up leaves that have fallen from trees, then you'll see there's motor activity at the time of the processing of the word. So it seems like many words, perhaps even all words, partly activate sensory motor cortex. Part of what they activate is sensory motor cortex. This creates a kind of ambiguity. Is there a sensory motor component, a literal part of the realizer of every mental representation? Or is it that any given mental process, the act of categorization, for instance, activates many distinct representations, some of which are in sensory motor cortex? So I know those two sound very similar, but the question is about what to kind of count as the realizer of a mental representation, or what to treat as a single representation. The way I just described neuroscientific results, and some of these are achieved in Alex Martin's lab, attach a name to them. Some of what you see in Martin's lab could be described as an activation of a single thing, a meaning of the word. And the meaning of the word includes activity in the part of cortex, temporal cortex, that represents words or is correlated with words. And it could, part of that single meaning might also be activity in motor cortex. But another way to think about this, the second way to think about it, is that this is a compound process. It's not an activation of a single thing, the meaning of the word. It's an activation of a representation of the word and a representation of motor activity and a bunch of other representations. And then we should take seriously those component representations. That there may be many distinct representations, some of which are in sensory motor cortex, but the representations in sensory motor cortex aren't part of the other representations. The representation of the word isn't in sensory motor cortex. So I take the correct answer here to be the latter, and this will provide the starting point for tomorrow's lecture. And the idea there is that the central idea that I want to allow for is that there may be many representations of that have the same value, that have the same content. This is something that we don't see enough of, I think, discussion of in the embodiment literature or elsewhere in cognitive science. This possibility that in your single cognitive system, you might have many different representations that they may play different roles in processing, but they all represent the same thing in the environment. It's sometimes claimed that there are 7 different bodily maps in different parts of the brain. So I don't think I don't know whether that exact count is right, but you find maps of the surface of the body in different areas. So if the number 7 is correct, that means there are 7 different representations in my brain of my right thumb. And interesting question is how those interact with each other, or how they coordinate their activity, or how they contribute alongside each other to produce bodily fluidity or skilled behavior. And I think this is part of what falls out of the embodied cognition research program, is that whenever, or very frequently anyway, maybe always, when we process input, some of what gets activated is in sensory motor cortex, and it contributes in important ways to what follows. But it doesn't mean that there aren't representations being activated in other parts of cortex that aren't particularly embodied or aren't particularly related to bodily activity. So we want to allow the possibility that both of those are happening. This is a bit like the comments I made toward the beginning of the lecture about the association-based interpretation of Casasanto and Chen and Barge's research, where an association develops between different representations, one of positive valence, one of the bus, because I have positive experiences on the bus, and you get a representation of these, they're more likely to be activated together in the future. But this is a kind of additional spin, or not a spin in a negative sense, but it's an additional aspect, a further twist. And the idea is that what can be activated are multiple representations of the same thing, multiple representations of the bus or multiple representations of my thumb. And some of those can be embodied while other ones are not. All right, well, that's a bit of a preview for tomorrow's lecture based on embodiment thinking. I included less material today because I've been trying not to overwhelm you, and also to leave room for discussion, although I might have underestimated a little bit how long today will talk would take. But anyway, I will have to end things there.